It's 11:35 and, it's 11:44, but I think you wouldn't mind if we start a little bit earlier and you'll have more time. Welcome to the panel, Class and the LGBT Experience. It's part of the conference How the Class Works. We have four presenters and three presentations. We have an hour 30 minutes. So we are very lucky because each of the presenters will have 20 minutes. And then at the end, we'll hold a question-answer session for half an hour. We are happy to have here Jeff Capuzzo and Todd Shaw. They are doing a presentation under the title Greed Beyond Stonewall, Class, Race, and the LGBT Economic Justice Movement. Next, we'll have Kim Palmer with the presentation Class and Queers, Heteronormativity, Culture, and Queer Conventions. And the third presenter is Sarah Smith with a presentation titled Gay and Lesbian Teachers and Struggle Against the BRIC Initiative. I'm happy to introduce Dr. Jeff Capuzzo and Dr. Todd Shaw. Jeff Capuzzo is an assistant professor at the Department of English and Cultural Studies at the Bryan University. He received his BA, MA, and recently, and what is more important, PhD in English from the University of Michigan. His teaching and research focus on U.S. ethnic studies, cultural studies, and women's studies. He's particularly interested in the relationship between interdisciplinary formation, cultural production, and social justice movements in the United States. His current research projects explore how the work of Filipino-American author and activist Carlos Bulacan and the emerging field of Filipino-American studies might offer new ways of developing racial literacy in the post-racial United States. Todd Shaw is an associate professor of political science and African-American studies at the University of South Carolina at Columbia. He researches and teaches broadly in the areas of African-American politics, urban politics, public policy. In 2009, Duke University Press published his book, Now is the Time, Detroit Black Politics and Grassroots Activism. I hope your book is available at our bookstore. So, let's start our first presentation.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you for the wonderful introduction. And Todd and I have been working on this project titled Beyond Barriers Beyond Stonewall, Class, Race, and LGBT Economic Justice Movement. And so let me start off with a few comments. Last year, around this time, the New York Public Library commemorated the 40th anniversary of the radicalization of the gay and lesbian community in the wake of the Stonewall Rebellion of 1969. One observer of the exhibit was deeply concerned about a particular shift in the LGBT movement over the past 40 years. In a review, we were asked to consider the following. Quote, compare the open, out, goal-oriented words, Gay Liberation Front, to the obscure, closeting human rights campaign, which emphasizes struggle more than solution. Consider the demands of gay power, black power, women power, student power, all power to the people, against today's pleas for acceptance and tolerance. Juxtapose radical lesbians, radical lesbians with the L word. So to be sure, 40 years since Stonewall, according to the headlines in the news, it seems that the top priority for the contemporary gay and lesbian movement in the United States is for acceptance and tolerance, the right to marriage, the right to serve openly in the U.S. military, and the right to attend the high school prom with one's same-sex partner. Of course, there's nothing wrong with any of these demands, which refuse second-class citizenship for gays and lesbians. The 40th anniversary of the gay liberation movement, however, provides an opportune moment to reflect upon what we're moving toward. Is it integration into the existing social order, or is it transformation of it? Do we just want to be out within what already exists, or can we imagine an alternative that's healthy for all people? So we see two major barriers or challenges in our post-Stonewall era to achieving genuine sexual freedom in society. One, a crisis in the vision of contemporary LGBT activism, or the third wave of sexual radicalism. And two, deepening inequalities within the LGBT community in a time of profound economic crisis. And we're particularly interested in the challenges of those on the margins of the LGBT community. So our central question this morning is, how are LGBT communities of color organizing to advance and deepen the liberatory vision of post-Stonewall sexual radicalism? Our project is in dialogue with two key articles that attempt to assess the development of queer activism from a class perspective. First is Queer in a Lean World by sociologist Alan Sears from 2000 that commemorates the 30th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion. That feels like yesterday for me. And second is Peter Drucker's new article published this month titled Socialist Feminist Questions About Queer Activism, the New Sexual Radicalism. Alan Sears and Peter Drucker help us to differentiate between first, second, and third waves of sexual radicalism. The first wave focused on sex reform movements occurring during the late 19th and early 20th century. The second wave surfaced in very visible ways during the gay and lesbian liberation movement of the 1960s and 1970s. Both Sears and Drucker made clear that the phenomenon of homosexual relations among men and women has existed for centuries in a variety of societies. Peter Drucker, however, argues that gay identity as we know it, particularly on a mass scale, is in fact amazingly recent, more a question of decades than centuries. Gay and lesbian identity emerged in the open with the second wave of sexual radicalism, the economic possibilities, the growth and transformation of the working and middle classes, and the development of social movements in post-war U.S. society opened spaces for gay and lesbian identities to develop into open and full-time lived relationships rather than as part-time relationships hidden in the shaded margins of one's heterosexual marriage or in the silent underground of one's life. The success of second wave sexual radicalism can be attributed to its relationship with other social movements at the time, especially second wave feminism, which provided a critique of capitalist patriarchy and drew energy from mass movements for change. By the late 1970s, the second wave of sexual radicalism evolved into the third wave against the backdrop of state repression of social movements and a corporate assault against the working class and communities of color around the globe. With the demise of social movements, the fragmentation of the working class, and the increased presence of corporate dominance in our daily lives, we witnessed the development of a commercialized gay lifestyle that situated sexual freedom within the realm of consumption. And this is dramatized in shows such as Queer as Folk, The L Word, and I'd like to add Sex and the City, and concretized by gay playgrounds of consumption in major cities across the country, like Boys Town Chicago, marked by visible rainbow flags, a variety of bars, muscled gay men who all look the same, and ATM machines in every corner. Despite the eventual commercialization of gay and lesbian life and identity, a third wave of LGBT activism developed and continues to exist. And this third wave actually includes two competing strands that developed throughout the decades. The first strand is a moderate reform orientation that dominated the movement during the 1980s. And the second strand is what's considered a queer activist current that erupted in the late 1980s through militant aid activism. And it is this second strand of third wave sexual radicalism, this queer activist current, that opened spaces for the creation of a variety of organizations such as ACT UP, AIDS Action Now, Queer Nation, and the Lesbian Avengers. In our post-Stonewall era, our challenge is to engage and advance this queer activist current in order to unlock the radical possibilities of the LGBT community. Both Drucker and Sears acknowledge the contributions and limitations of queer activism. Its contributions are listed in the following. The emphasis on visibility, difference, direct action, refusal to assimilate to the dominant culture, and the fluidity and diversity of sexual desire. And one of its major limitations, according to Peter Drucker and Helen Sears, is its lack of vision for an alternative social order. So our central question this morning resonates with two key points by Helen Sears and Peter Drucker in their assessment of queer activism. One, people of color, immigrant communities, and the working class have been marginalized by the queer activist current due to its privileging of the cultural dimensions of LGBT identity over its material dimension, meaning a celebration of multiple and fluid identities over any engagement with class inequality. So in our next section, Todd will highlight the material dimension of LGBT identity in our time of economic crisis. And then in our final section, we respond to Peter Drucker's call for radical queers to take up, to quote, take up and develop analyses that an earlier radical generation made during the lesbian gay liberation movement. And we'll highlight two progressive LGBT organizations in New York City that address the barriers, or what we see as barriers beyond Stonewall. One challenge or barrier is the challenge of sustaining a radical vision for change that pushes against the commodification of gay and lesbian life. And the second challenge or barrier is the challenge of recognizing and engaging the material inequalities within the LGBT community. And I'll turn it over to Todd.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Toward the end of having a little television show. And feel free to follow along. I'm going to uncharacteristically read my narrative here to keep myself pithy, but feel free to follow along with the chart there, the tables there. So from the previous section, we have discussed Drucker and Sears' critique of how third wave queer activism, queer identities and activism, were shaped by the structural contradictions induced by neoliberalism. In this section, we will touch upon the contemporary material conditions that emanate out of the racial, gendered, and sexualized inequalities that confront third wave activists as they imagine a transformation of the current order. We will discuss various forms of evidence for these material conditions with the proviso that all of it is based upon limited conceptions of who is part of the broader queer LGBT community. Just one example relative to the data I'm showing you versus what we ought to really measure. Just one example is our need to train much more or a greater attention upon the various forms of economic oppression that confront the transgender community or communities, transgender persons, 26% of whom reported in a recent 2009 study as losing their job because they are transgender, and an overwhelming 97% of who report being mistreated at work. Still, when considering questions of well-being as measured in a limited way by income and poverty, it's fundamentally important to, in the words of Abadjit, among others, to recognize, quote, the myth of affluence among gay, lesbian, and bisexual Americans, unquote. R. Bradley Sears, Gary Gates, and William Rubenstein noted in their 2005 report on same-sex couples and same-sex couples raising children in the United States that, quote, the picture of same-sex couples raising children presented by the Census 2000 is quite different than the popular conception that gay people are predominantly gay, affluent, urban, white, and childless. In fact, these authors correct this misconception in providing evidence that, quote, individuals in same-sex couples raising children do not fare as well as their different sex counterparts. They are less affluent, more racially and ethnically diverse. A 2007 Williams Institute study of census data bears this out in that overall, quote, same-sex partners in the U.S. have fewer financial resources to support their children than do different sex married partners, unquote. In fact, these same-sex households with children have median incomes that are, in 2000, were a whopping 23% lower than the income of different sex married parents. However, the 2000 census reveals people of color in same-sex households comprise a larger share of all same-sex households. That is the case for their different same-sex married counterparts. For example, black same-sex couples are 8.7% of all same-sex households, according to the census, but black different-sex couples are 6.7% of the total. So according to a bevy of research that has analyzed the 2000 census, among other sources that we should, definitely should draw upon, and its limited reporting of self-identified same-sex couple households, especially the excellent summary of the Queers for Economic Justice report entitled Tidal Wave, and I refer you to that report, it's very important to clarify the distinct and stark inequalities and vastly different lived and material conditions of LGBTQ citizens of color as opposed to those of their white counterparts. We reference the work of Albeda et al. In presenting table 6 and 8. So there's table 6 and 8 now. Whereas 4.1% of married same-sex households who are white fall below the federal poverty line. A little less than half of, or about 2.7% of this white same-sex male couples fall below that line, but 4.3% of white female same-sex couples fall below that line. However, in comparison, 9.3% of married different-sex black couples fall below that line, while 14.4% of black male couples, or let me stress, 7 times the rate of their white counterparts, and 21% of black female same-sex couples, or let me stress, more than 5 times the rate of their white counterparts, are in poverty. These patterns of disparity continue among Native Americans and to some degree among Asian American Pacific Islanders, as well as those who classify themselves by a different race. These patterns also hold fairly true for those who self-identify as Hispanic. Even more startling are the details Albeda et al. Present in Table 9 of the percent of poor children in couple families by household type. Whereas the still surprising 15.9% of children who live in households headed by white male couples are in poverty, that's 15.9%, 13.8% of children who live in white female couple households live in poverty. But an astonishing 27.9% of children who live in black male couple households and 31% of children who live in black female couple households live in poverty. The news does not get any better because 41% of children who live in Native American Alaskan male couple households live in poverty as compared to 29.4% of children in co-ethnic female couple households. Similarly disparaging patterns hold across other people of color, especially those who self-identify as Hispanic, where 26.9% of children in Hispanic male couple households live in poverty and 31.9% of children who live in Hispanic female couple households live in poverty. As Drucker aptly noted, the commodification of LGBT spaces and public spheres, such again as the Boys Town reference, grossly distorts at times not only the complexities of the material well-being of people of color, but also as of white gay males, which simply serves to reproduce fundamental class inequalities.
Thanks, Todd. And so what we'd like to do now to end our presentation is to highlight two organizations in New York City that we see as providing creative ways of addressing what we see as the barriers beyond Stonewall. Again, one, the challenge of sustaining a radical vision for change that pushes against the commodification of gay and lesbian life. And then two, the challenge of recognizing and engaging these material inequalities within the LGBT community. And the two organizations that we look at one is the Audre Lorde Project, and another organization is Queers for Economic Justice. Audre Lorde Project, the AOP, or Queers for Economic Justice, QEJ. These two organizations provide approaches to understanding the material dimensions of LGBT identity within a larger framework of struggling for human rights and justice for all marginalized, oppressed, and exploited people. All right, so let me just talk very briefly about the goals and scope of each organization. The Audre Lorde Project, as many of you probably know, I mean, it's named after the Caribbean American poet, teacher, and activist Audre Lorde. Lorde's activism and published work, and this is from the website, speak to the importance of struggle for liberation among oppressed peoples and of organizing in coalition across differences of race, gender, sexual orientation, class, age, and ability. And let me just highlight just a few statements from the Audre Lorde Project website. They say that the AOP is a lesbian, gay, bisexual, two-spirit, trans, and gender non-conforming, that's LGBT, STGNC, people of color, Center for Community Organizing, focusing on the New York City area. Through mobilization, education, and capacity building, the AOP works for community wellness and progressive social and economic justice. They also highlight that the AOP was initiated as an organizing effort by a coalition of LGBT, ST, G, and V people of color, and it was first brought together by advocates for gay men of color. This was a multiracial network of gay men of color, HIV policy, and advocates in 1994. Queers for Economic Justice is, this is from their website, a progressive nonprofit organization committed to promoting economic justice in the context of sexual and gender liberation. And what I love about some of their statements, they make very clear about what the scope of their project is. And one is, really, their goal is to challenge and change the systems that create poverty and economic injustice in our communities, and to promote an economic system that embraces sexual and gender diversity. Okay? All right. What we want to highlight with the Audre Lorde Project and Queers for Economic Justice is that we find that these two organizations provide fascinating contributions to, one, to how we see the world, and this is the notion of theory, and how we engage the world in terms of practice. And so let me just give an example in terms of theory. These two organizations re-articulate the notion of intersectionality, and I bring that up because that might be something that might be old hat, but I know in our courses, and I teach undergraduate courses in cultural studies, all the faculty in our department talk about intersectionality, right? The whole trinity of race, class, gender. So what this organization does, the Audre Lorde Project and Queers for Economic Justice, instead of intersectionality of reified identities, they're interested in the intersectionality of forms of oppression. They build upon Patricia Hill Collins' concept of a matrix of domination to articulate a systemic approach to understanding interlocking forms of oppression within the system of capitalism. So the bottom line for the Audre Lorde Project and Queers for Economic Justice is that sexual freedom cannot be achieved in isolation from other forms of oppression and exploitation within capitalism. And I just want to highlight two statements before I end. The Audre Lorde Project, what I love about the work that they do is that they actually issued a statement on the inauguration, the eve of the inauguration of President Obama. And in the statement, they recognized the amazing grassroots mobilization, especially among young people, to usher in Obama. But they also realized that Obama is very much committed to neoliberal approaches to the economy. So they said, for LGBT people who are committed to struggling for sexual freedom, there are other things that should be on our agenda: the economic crisis, police brutality, privatization, war and militarization, immigration, the rise against homophobia, which is interlocked with the attacks on affirmative action, reproductive rights, immigration rights, and the rights of workers. What we also noticed with the Queers for Economic Justice is that since 2006, they've been involved in the campaign to broaden the terrain upon which we struggle for marriage equality. So what they argue is that marriage equality can't be a standalone issue. Really, the major contradiction in the struggle for marriage is this. What does it mean to have access to an institution, right, marriage as an institutional capitalism, that in turn grants access to resources that are increasingly privatized? So they actually have two requests, that in our movement forward for marriage equality, that recognize multiple forms of families within our struggle for marriage equality. For example, senior citizens living together should be recognized as a family, adult children living and caring for their aging parents, or caregiving and partnership relationships that have developed to provide support systems for people living with HIV and AIDS. And the struggle for marriage equality must be situated within a larger critique of the neoliberal attack on the public and on public resources. So really what we see, and we'll just end here, is that these two organizations actually build upon the best of the queer activist current, but also push it forward. They build upon the queer activist current, which was very much critical of integrating into the system as it is, but they also build upon the systemic class analysis of an earlier generation of activists, such as Audre Lorde from second wave sexual radicalism. We also look at their connection with the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton's statement to support gay and women's liberation. And Harry Hay, the labor organizer and gay activist, the founder of the Madison Society, who bridged the old and new left current in the United States. So the Audre Lorde Project and Queers for Economic Justice remind us that LGBT struggle for sexual freedom, the freedom to love without fear, must be understood as integral to the struggle for economic justice for all. Okay. I know that's over to you.
Thank you for your insightful presentation, and especially for making sense to those numbers. There are Our next presenter is Dr. Kim Palmore. She is the director of professional development in the graduate division of the University of California at Riverside, where she received her PhD in English. Her specialties are 20th century British and American literatures with an emphasis on gay and lesbian texts in queer theory. Her dissertation is titled Playing and Passing, Expressions of Identity and the Destabilization of Gender Construction. The title of her presentation is Classing Queer Heteronormativity, Culture, and the Queer Convention.
Thank you. Thank you. This is my first Hot Buzz Conference one. Hot Buzz Works Conference. Okay. In fact, I have little experience talking about class, even though I was raised in a poor, worked our way up to working class family. I'm formed by the merging of two groups, Catholic Democrats and Native American drinkers. We were taught to work hard, pay cash, and avoid authority. My mother graduated from a small high school in South Dakota, and my father from a rural California third grade class. Colleges then, of course, were for other people. We celebrated, though, that we were free to achieve the American dream, free to work hard enough, try hard enough, and be good enough to make it in a country that guarantees success to all that earn it. These beginnings, cultures, and beliefs informed both my class and my perception of myself. From the time I enrolled at Long Beach City College until I finally earned my PhD some 20 years later, I believe that my failure to succeed faster was my failure to focus, my failure to apply myself, and my failure to be able to simultaneously work full-time and attend school full-time. The university taught me to be understanding of the plight of racial minorities denied rights and opportunities whites receive. And I am. But believing that that was the only truth obscured the truth about my own upbringing. I believe that because I looked white, remember I was Indian, it's on one side, there were no serious challenges to my success. Except maybe this like Butch Queer thing I got going, right? So I studied queerness. My dissertation's about queerness. My specialty is queerness. But by the time I worked in the identity politics of queerness, I realized that queerness and every other identity category seemingly intersects with class. Isn't that funny? So I can't ignore that or discount this anymore. So this is my first attempt at thinking about class and queers. Some of my insights are likely not new, but they are new to me. Some are only partially formed, but they're moving in a good direction, I think. And some might just be wrong, but I beg your indulgence while I work through this new critical lens. Today I want to talk about the ways in which class dynamics are being transmitted and transformed inside of queer culture. About a culture folding in on itself and accepting the constructed class hierarchy and traditional models of behavior in order to achieve middle class status and enjoy the privileges associated with belonging to the mainstream. I want to talk about gays and lesbians in this era of liberal tolerance, conforming to heteronormative standards in order to reclaim a class standing often lost to homophobia and heterosexism. Generally, we applaud this mainstreaming of gays and lesbians. But we fail to realize how much that mainstreaming depends not just on imitation heteronormativity, but middle-class heteronormativity. I will demonstrate this by referring to two periods in lesbian history. The 70s move toward androgyny, and the current move toward gender-sex conformity. In the 1940s and 1950s lesbian community, a rich period in the history of butch-femme relations, it exemplifies the classing of lesbians. It was during this era that a working-class butch-femme community became visible to both other lesbians and the larger society, precisely because of its clearly defined gender roles. Lesbians sought refuge in community, and the visibility of this group invited women from all classes to enter and thus to engage a new culture. For some women, doing so represented a downward mobility, reinforced by the demonized position of being a lesbian. This intersection of gender performance and lesbianism both reinforced and recreated butch-femme culture as part of the working class. The main critique of this period is centered on the imitation of heterosexuality. Some theorists contend that role playing was done out of ignorance or a misguided desire to be men. Historian Lillian Faderman offers a critique of butch-femme roles as replicas of heterosexuality, particularly those exhibited by the working class. Others, including Judith Butler, argue that while the butch-femme dynamic may seem parallel to working class heterosexual relationships, it actually both imitates and subverts the pattern. Both discussions have merit. But what is true from either perspective is that both butch and femme were queer in terms of gender presentation. A non-traditional presentation, I argue, still relegates those who experience it to the lower class. Because it was an imitation of working class heterosexuality, this imitation heteronormativity did not lead to mainstreaming, but rather to blatant exclusion from the feminist and lesbian feminist drive to mainstream. In the 60s and the 70s, the women's movement began a process of interrogating patriarchy that benefited both heterosexual women and lesbians. But butch femme was ridiculed as part of the patriarchy women were trying to dismantle. According to those contemporary feminists, such role playing was obsolete. Lesbian feminists inscribed role playing as a working class phenomenon and focused on the reform of the butch femme diet. The socially correct and politically expedient androgyny, or feminine gender performance, erased layers of difference between lesbians and straight feminists. Lack of gender and sex congruity, then, was conversely perverse and unacceptable. This incongruity was particularly visible in butch women, but also apparent in femmes, who parodied heterosexual femininity and overperformed traditional feminine female behavior. At best, giving them the benefit of the doubt. Not understanding the class implications of such ridicule, feminists ostracized those who refused to conform. The larger lesbian community embraced the distinction between, on one hand, androgynous or cisgender, meaning sex and gender congruent, expression, and on the other hand, butch femme, calling the latter couple's role players an unfeminist. This intracultural classing helped distance the new androgynous lesbians from the working class butch femme culture of the 50s. And it allowed both feminists and lesbian feminists to claim some measure of both social acceptance and middle class identity. Their presentation of themselves as cisgendered reinforced the idea of sameness and therefore acceptability. During this period, these more mainstream looking lesbians were given some small bit of recognition, some social validation, because they were clearly less deviant than the genderqueer butch femme lesbians. Ultimately, this status elevation resulted in fairer distribution through better jobs and housing, and in many cases created bridges between themselves and the families who had initially denied them. Contrarily, the butch femme dyads were locked into the working class status they had long occupied. They remained unemployable, except in non-sanctioned or working class jobs. The butches in traditionally masculine but low-paying jobs. The femmes, while they fared better than the butches on the job market, still found themselves alienated from their families and living in low-rent districts with unemployed or underemployed butches. Neither butches nor femmes found substantial educational opportunities, given the lack of familial, economic, and institutional support. Butches and femmes and other gender deviants were locked into the working class based on their bodies, expressions, and the company they kept. Specifically, each other. They were targeted and distanced from both more acceptable lesbians and the feminist movement. Butch and femme lesbians were denied both recognition and economic opportunity because of their gender performance. Abandoning butch femme and embracing androgyny, then, elevated one's class status, both within the lesbian community and the larger heterosexual society. Both gays and lesbians and straight society demonized certain lesbians and gay men, calling them working class. And although homosexuality was increasingly acceptable in society, it was a middle class version of homosexuality. Good gays were cisgendered or androgynous. Bad gays played roles. Imitation of the working class did not yield acceptance into the mainstream, but rather intensified marginalization. The growing mainstream acceptance of some gays and lesbians became apparent in 1974, which many of you don't remember. When the American Psychiatric Association, when I was there, removed homosexuality from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. However, gender identity dysphoria, that is, non-conforming gender expression, remains pathologized even today in the DSM. Although it will be revised this year, and so I think there's some hope that it might be removed, but I wouldn't hold my breath. It might be going another 10 years. Those women and men who fail to conform to gender standards, including those people who identify or perform butch femme, remain social and sexual deviants because of the assertion that their gender dissonance or performance is a mental illness. At the turn of this century, the new out queer movement was gaining strength. This queer movement, much like the lesbian feminist movement of the 70s, features both good gays and bad gays. But now the roles shift depending on who tells the story, which complicates both the idea of truth and my assertions. Some people identify the good gays as those who partner for life in monogamous relationships or try to imitate other traditional heterosexual values. Have kids or buy a house, get a dog or a cat, get a college degree or a white-collar job, and pay taxes. I will call these people gay and lesbian traditionalists in my effort to avoid creating a binary that imitates good and bad. In this scenario of good gays and traditionalists, the bad gays, then, are the gender deviants, sex workers, HIV-infected people, those with multiple partners, cross-dressers, and so on. We'll call them the queer culturalists. Other people, though, including many queer activists, call the gay and lesbian traditionalists bad, precisely because they imitate heteronormativity. They imitate straight people, which is bad. It's bad. Straight people have such a high divorce rate. You don't want to imitate that. And they're lots of kids, you know, and all kind of problems. So you don't want to imitate that. The good gays, then, in this scenario, are the queer culturalists, who are radical, deviant, and wild, right? They resist conformity. Truthfully, sometimes, the good and the bad on both sides are the same people. But we're going to resist this complication in order to focus on the role of class and choosing the issue. I have to resist this complication. I'll be here all day. The traditionalists, then, are those embracing heteronormativity, traditional social behaviors. These gays and lesbians aim to be released from the criminalizing status of homosexuality that automatically relegated them to a lower class. They claim or reclaim their middle class status by embracing mainstream values and imitating or participating in heteronormative culture. The mainstream audience in the liberal middle and upper middle classes understands and supports the emancipation of gays and lesbians in the 21st century. The gay and lesbian traditionalists provide an acceptable group of gays and lesbians with which the non-queers can socialize, thus establishing their open-mindedness and legitimizing their liberalness. The traditionalists differ from the heterosexual community specifically only in terms of sexual orientation, but not greatly in terms of culture. They often promote appropriate gender and sex congruency. They have effectively left the gay and lesbian community for the greater social group. There are multiple outcomes from this move. Orientation is posed as acceptable and gender queerness as unacceptable, which allows employers, landlords, and officials to assert fairness while other queer people are still denied basic rights and services. The more affluent traditionalists no longer contribute economic power to the queer movement. The queer culturalists who do not, cannot, or refuse to merge or melt into the mainstream are forced into a binary position which seems essentialist, separatist, and radical by comparison. Female queer culturalists are doubly discriminated against in both recognition and distribution. All of these outcomes contribute to the policing of class boundaries and distinctions. Unsurprisingly, white gay men are in the vanguard of the traditionalist group. They are two males in a relationship and have unplanned children far less often than their lesbian counterparts. They do have planned children, but unplanned children, not so much. In general, they are 15 to 20% more affluent than even heterosexuals. This in itself makes them candidates to claim middle class status in the face of this decriminalization of homosexuality. The success of this reclamation movement has led to a conservative push for gay men to assert or present or perform cisgender in order to assure this acceptance in the middle class. The conservative traditionalist Andrew Sullivan, a gay journalist, openly suggests that gay men should embrace their masculinity. Like the men, lesbians too are being encouraged to embrace traditional gender to resist queerness. What I've witnessed is an increase in a willingness to conform. These lesbian candidates for upper and middle class use cultural capital and social skills to obtain or resecure a place in the mainstream society. The femmes of yesteryear are often now just traditionally feminine. They pass into the larger work culture unnoticed. The butches of yesteryear often become trans men and embrace their masculinity as men. These lesbians use either their own economic solvency or their upper middle class parents to pay for reconstructive surgery because of this pressure to conform and to fall into the middle class. They are often applauded for accepting their gender deviancy and seeking appropriate medical help to eliminate the problem. Choosing transsexual surgery aligns the mind and body. It straightens queerness, interrupts the feeling of queerness by shifting the focus to the physical. Yet surgery does little more than reinforce a gender binary that obliges people to behave in prescriptive patterns. It reinforces heteronormativity and the class patterns that are part of that system. The straightening of queerness, this aligning of gender and sex, either by choosing that behavior or by modifying the body, the brain, promotes the social acceptability of the gay traditionalists while marginalizing the queer culturalists. Class acceptability, class conformity, then, is a necessary step in achieving gay and lesbian mainstreaming. Just as the feminist movement toward androgyny and mainstreaming had unrecognized class implications, so too do the current queer movements in their responses to heteronormativity. This happened in the butch femme exclusion of the 1960s and 70s. The result of mainstreaming is an in-group social policing. The outcomes of queer middle classing will likely repeat those of the earlier period's activism. People will be classed based on both the body and performance. Economic, social, and cultural privilege will remain unequal. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation on intersectionality and telling a story about good and bad, about role playing and authenticity and the traditionalists and culturalists. And now we should move to our third presenter, who is Sarah Smith, and she is going to present on gay and lesbian teachers and struggle against the BRICS initiative. Sarah Smith is currently working as a full-time organizer for the American Association of University Professors at the University of California. Recently, she was a PhD candidate in the Department of History at Santa Cruz, where she concentrated on labor, queer, and social movement history of the United States. Her dissertation is on rank and file teachers organizing in California.
Thank you for that introduction. So in 1978, Republican State Senator John Briggs from Orange County spearheaded an effort to pass an initiative in California, which, if passed, would have made it illegal for out gays, lesbians, and their straight supporters to teach in the public school system. The Briggs Initiative, which was also known as Prop 6, was on the California ballot on November 7, 1978. The initiative read, in part, one of the most fundamental interests of the state is the establishment and preservation of the family unit. Consistent with this interest is the state's duty to protect its impressionable youth from influences which are antithetical to this vital interest. The state finds a compelling interest in refusing to employ and in terminating the employment of a school teacher, a teacher's aide, a school administrator, or a counselor who engages in public homosexual activity and or public homosexual conduct directed at or likely to come to the attention of school children or other school employees, unquote. Though polls taken just a few months prior to the November election showed majority support for the Briggs Initiative, it ultimately failed by a wide margin, with 59% voting no and 41% voting yes. So in this presentation, I examine the campaign to defeat the Briggs Initiative with a focus on the critical role that rank-and-file gay and lesbian teachers and school workers played in the initiative's defeat, both inside and outside of the teachers' unions. This history demonstrates the power of social movement unionism that extends beyond the workplace to incorporate broader demands for social justice. Through their organizing, gay and lesbian teachers and school workers influence the teachers' unions, particularly the American Federation of Teachers, to actively oppose the Briggs Initiative. Gays and lesbians, however, did not confine their activities to lobbying the teachers' unions. They formed their own groups, the lesbian school workers and the gay teachers and school workers in the Bay Area and the gay teachers of Los Angeles, and worked independently of the unions to build opposition to the Briggs Initiative. They also were involved in broader gay-led community organizations working to defeat the Briggs Initiative across the state. Though the teachers' unions played an important role in the campaign to defeat the Briggs Initiative, they did not lead its organizing. It was a work by gays and lesbians in the community alongside the organizing of gay and lesbian teachers that was critical in the defeat of the Briggs Initiative. So State Senator John Briggs, described variously by his opponents as a rabid right-winger, a reactionary lunatic, and an idiot, hoped that sponsoring this initiative would increase his popularity and propel him to the governorship. In the late 1970s, gay and lesbian rights were rapidly becoming a favorite target of the newly galvanized Christian right. Anita Bryant's successful crusade against gay rights in Dade County, Florida in 1977, reached prominence nationally, proving to be a launching pad for campaigns against gay rights in cities and states across the country. Bryant, Briggs, and the Christian right saw gay and lesbian rights the coming apocalypse. If gay was good, that necessarily meant the downfall of the straight nuclear family, which all that was good in right society depended on. The Christian right argued that gay people posed a threat to children, which led to their focus on the public schools. John Briggs and his group, California Defend Our Children, accused gay people of being child molesters and seeking to recruit children to homosexuality. A pamphlet put out by California Defend Our Children pronounced that, quote, homosexuals, end quote, sought, quote, to be legitimized in their perverted lifestyles so they may influence our children to adopt homosexuality, end quote. Briggs and others in the Christian right found a receptive audience to their idea that gay people posed a unique threat to children. A Gallup poll in the summer of 1977 found that 65% of those polled were opposed to hiring gays and lesbians as elementary school teachers. This highlighted for people like Briggs that there was a good deal of potential political capital to be gained by narrowing in on gays and lesbians in the schools. Briggs, of course, never became governor of California, despite his hopes, in large part due to the massive mobilization against this initiative. The urgency of the need to defeat Briggs provoked a massive amount of organizing. Gays and lesbians led the way in the campaign to defeat the Briggs Initiative as they started to mobilize as early as 1977, while activists in the Bay Area and LA in particular led the way, they inspired and at times directly facilitated organizing in other areas of the state. Amber Hollybaugh, a San Francisco-based activist in the campaign to defeat Briggs, remembers working largely in rural areas, going door to door to convince people to vote against the Briggs Initiative. Straight allies also gradually came on board. Trade unions, community groups, political parties, socialist groups, and even some churches spoke out against the Briggs Initiative. This organizing culminated in large-scale demonstrations, lots of media work, and countless fundraisers and educational events. Gay and lesbian teachers and school workers played a particularly important role in the movement to defeat the Briggs Initiative. In the Bay Area, there were two organizations, the Gay Teachers and School Workers and the Lesbian School Workers, who actively worked to defeat Briggs. The gay teachers and school workers seemed to consist primarily of white men and women, including Tom Omiyana, who was presently a Democrat in the California State Assembly. The group's politics were leftist. They wrote in their newsletter, quote, "We believe that discrimination against gay teachers arises as part of a system of sexism, racism, and class oppression that pervades our country," unquote. They, moreover, directly countered the Christian right's claims that gays and lesbians, but particularly gay men, were dangerous to children. They wrote, quote, "We have been accused of child molesting, recruitment, and trying to influence children's sexuality. In fact, statistics, observation, and common sense prove that sexuality is not determined by the sexual orientation of the teacher or the school worker. In addition, studies show that most sex crimes are committed by so-called normal straight men." So organizing against the Briggs Initiative became the primary focus for the gay teachers and school workers in 77 and 78. They described their work as providing, quote, living testimony against such anti-gay legislation. The group viewed the initiative not only as being an attack on gay people, but also as anti-labor, as it would have provided local school boards with more power over teachers and other school workers. The Lesbian School Workers was born out of the gay teachers and school workers, though, according to those involved, this happened very organically, quote, organically and not through conflict. Though Ellen Broidy, a member of the group, did remember that lesbian school workers formed as a separate organization for lesbians in part because, quote, men took up a lot of space. Most of those involved were college-educated, young, and white. The politics of the lesbian school workers were feminist and radically left, in many ways similar to the gay teachers and school workers, though there was at least one important difference. The lesbian school workers actively opposed the pro-death penalty initiative, Proposition 7, also on the ballot in November of 1978. Prop 7, also sponsored by Senator Briggs, and which ultimately passed by an overwhelming margin, greatly extended the prison terms for people convicted of murder, as well as expanded the circumstances for imposing the death penalty. The lesbian school workers distinguished themselves from most other gay and lesbian groups working against Briggs' Proposition 6 by also being outspoken against Proposition 7. They emphasized that the poor and people of color were already disproportionately sentenced to long prison terms and sentenced to death in larger numbers than other segments of the population. Proposition 7 would, of course, only exacerbate these disparities. So in response to Briggs' attacks on gays and lesbians in the schools, the lesbian school workers asserted that they played a positive role in the classroom because they were in a unique position to teach children to reject rigid gender roles that teach boys that they are superior to girls. Because, quote, gay school workers do not conform to fixed roles for men and women, unquote. The lesbian school workers did not focus on the teachers' unions. Instead, they were a collectively run group of rank and file lesbian teachers, school workers, and others working at the grassroots to defeat both Prop 6 and 7. They primarily focused on education and fundraising, both of which went hand in hand. The third group I examined, the Gay Teachers of Los Angeles, worked most directly to persuade the teacher unions to actively oppose the Briggs Initiative, though they also organized independently of the teacher unions. In 1978, the Gay Teachers of Los Angeles worked with the Gay Teachers and School Workers of San Francisco to vigorously pressure the California Federation of Teachers to oppose the Briggs Initiative. At the CFT convention in San Diego in May of 1978, Norman McClellan led the first ever gay workshop entitled, quote, Is Homosexuality Catching the Gay Teacher Reality versus Myth, end quote, with an attendance of about 40 people. GTLA also helped to organize a campaign alongside both gay and non-gay people from United Teachers Los Angeles and, quote, our San Diego friends, to have delegates wear black armbands with a pink Stop Briggs triangle, ultimately succeeding in persuading about 250 delegates to wear the armband. GTLA passed an anti-Briggs resolution at a UTLA meeting in March of 78, and then brought this resolution to the summer CFT convention. The resolution stated the CFT's opposition to the Briggs Initiative, but it also acknowledged that gays and lesbians have experienced discrimination for years and encouraged all teachers union locals to bargain to include sexual orientation in their union contracts non-discrimination clauses. The resolution also supported the inclusion of, quote, sexual minority studies in all counselor and teacher training curricula. The efforts of gay and lesbian teachers and responsive leadership led the California Federation of Teachers to sign on to a lawsuit to prevent the initiative from going onto the ballot, publicly endorse and sponsor numerous educational events and protests against the Briggs Initiative, and donate money to the campaign to defeat Briggs. In a televised debate, when John Briggs was reminded that a number of organizations publicly opposed Proposition 6, including the CFT, the Young Republicans at this point, and the California Democratic Party, among others, Briggs responded, quote, The ones you named, for the most part, are all homosexually oriented or are advocates of homosexuality, unquote. It's unclear which of these two descriptions Briggs felt best applied to the Teachers Federation. Ron Tillet, president of the CFT at the time, spoke to a crowd of 250,000 gay rights demonstrators in San Francisco in June of 1978, announcing, quote, We are here today to demonstrate to the John Briggses and Anita Bryans in our society that we do not intend to permit the stench of fear to return to California public school classrooms, a clear reference to McCarthyism. The American Federation of Teachers also publicly opposed the Briggs Initiative, though not unproblematically. The anti-Briggs resolution passed at the AFT convention in Washington, D.C. in August of 78 was much less progressive than the resolution passed at the CFT convention a few months earlier. GTLA called the union out for its timidity in their newsletter from September of 1978, remarking, quote, The leadership of the AFT appeared to be afraid of gay teachers' rights. They were especially opposed to any use of the words gay, homosexual, or sexual orientation in any resolutions. There were two resolutions up for a vote on the convention floor, and according to GTLA, the AFT leadership had, quote, prearranged to sabotage both resolutions, seeking instead to pass a resolution based on a 1973 policy statement, quote, supporting the rights of teachers to conduct their private lives without harassment, unquote. A number of gay teachers got together to successfully lobby James Ballard, then president of San Francisco AFT Local 61, to introduce a more strongly worded substitute resolution. However, Ballard refused to support an even more robust resolution on gay rights put forward by these same teachers. The resolution that did pass cited the 1973 policy statement on privacy, but added wording specifically objecting to the BRICS initiative. So the different language of the resolution passed the CFT convention, likely points to the more progressive leadership in California, but also underscores the hard work that rank-and-file gay and lesbian teachers throughout California put into lobbying the California Union to speak out for gay rights. James Fowler, whose substitute motion passed in place of the more progressive motion, came from a San Francisco local that actually successfully bargained over the inclusion of protections against intrusions into their, quote, private lives of teachers, and was generally well ahead of other AFT locals on the subject of gay rights. However, the fact that Ballard was running for the position of vice president as a member of the politically dominant progressive caucus at the AFT convention in 1978 may point to a political bind that he was in. The progressive caucus was, after all, the caucus of the same AFT leadership that the gay teachers of Los Angeles claimed sought to sabotage both the successful resolution that Ballard did end up proposing, in addition to the more progressive failed motion that actually mentions the word gay. Educator and lawyer Karen Harbeck points out that Albert Schenker, who was the president of the AFT in 1978 and leader in the Progressive Caucus, asserted later in 1985 that the issue of gay teachers was too marginal and controversial to merit the AFT's support. So on election night on November 8, 1978, many who had worked tirelessly at the defeat of the BRICS initiative came together to watch the election results as they came in. In San Francisco, people gathered at the Market Street headquarters of the NC6 campaign to watch the election results. Upon hearing that the BRICS initiative was defeated, people cheered and stomped their feet and poured into the streets to celebrate. San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk used the occasion to urge people to come out to their friends and families. Sally Gearhart, professor at San Francisco State, explained, quote, "Not only are we good and true and beautiful, but we have lots of friends," unquote. While Larry Berner, a gay teacher, ecstatic to hear the news, nevertheless warned, quote, "Just because we won doesn't mean we've eliminated prejudice against homosexuals," unquote. Lesbians and gays led the way in the fight to defeat the BRICS initiative, and the organizing of rank-and-file gay and lesbian teachers and school workers clearly played a critical role in this movement. It was because of their organizing that the teachers union spoke out against the BRICS initiative. But this was a fraught victory. Proposition 7, the death penalty initiative, passed overwhelmingly, in no small part because much of the gay and lesbian movement, as well as the teachers' unions, did not prioritize speaking out against it. Furthermore, the teachers' unions did not do all they could to defeat BRICS, considering the incredibly sweeping impact the initiative would have had on a large minority of gay and lesbian teachers and school workers throughout the state of California had it passed. The fact that the teachers' unions were much more active in the campaign to defeat Proposition 13, the anti-tax initiative passed in June of 1978 in California, underscores that the teachers' union still had a long way to go on the issue of gay rights. The late 1970s marked the beginning of the forging of alliances between the queer movement and the labor movement. Despite some of the problems I outlined, the teachers' unions, especially in California, have been cited as the earliest unions to take on gay rights in any meaningful way. This history, moreover, demonstrates that it was necessary for gay and lesbian teachers and school workers to organize around their own identities to pressure the leadership of the teachers' unions to oppose this discriminatory ballot initiative. The campaign to defeat the BRICS initiative also shows power that comes from social movement unionism. Labor sociologists, historians, as well as activists within the labor movement have pointed to the potential that comes from harnessing the inherent power of the labor movement to make broader social change, change not only confined to the bread and butter issues of the workplace. In other words, the rank and file gay and lesbian teachers and school workers in the story were trying to put the movement back in the labor movement by demanding that the teachers' unions make common cause with community organizations fighting for social justice.
Thank you, Sarah, for your presentation about strategies and motivations and what is more important about the success of anti-BRICS initiative. We are so good with time that we are lucky to have half an hour for our answer question and answer session. What I ask everyone to do is to identify yourself and then to ask a question to the presenter.
My name is Jim Collins. I'm from upstate New York and a member of the SUNY system. So I'm active in the UUP, the United University Professionals. So my question is going to be about sort of union connections to the issues that y'all are addressing. But first, I just want to thank everybody for three wonderful presentations. There's an awful lot of good information, a lot of sort of humor, bit of inspiration and a lot of sort of thought provoking. My question is really whether, maybe it's to everybody, although it might call first to Sarah Smith, whether there you see sort of efforts in various unions anywhere in the country to sort of advance LGBT issues, in a sense to sort of help defend the class interests of LGBT people. And I'm asking this because within my own union, in conjunction with what's supposed to be AFL-CIO, there's a private work initiative, but I've signed on to it, but we don't seem to be doing very much around it, so I don't actually know its status. But it attracted me because it said we want to be able to defend people's, at least their sort of rights in the workplace to gender expression, sexual orientation, and so forth. You started your portion of the talk by saying that people have experienced a lot of harassment in the workplace. I guess that's my question. How do these union efforts help?
How do union efforts help advance the rights of?
Yeah, things like private work. I guess I'm asking, what's the situation in 2010 rather than 1970?
So I would say one of the main advancements in the work that private work does in recent years is advocating for the rights of transgender workers, specifically including gender identity or expression and non-discrimination clauses in union contracts, bargaining over transgender inclusive health coverage, access to all the services and procedures that transgender people need to transition medically. That's one major advancement that's happened recently. There was a transgender caucus that was formed within Pride at Work in the last 2 years. I think it was 2005 or something like that. I don't have a statistic, you know, I can't think of statistics off the top of my mind, but unions have, and especially throughout the 90s and the 2000s, been negotiating over the rights of LGBT people more and more. They're just beginning to actually deal with the rights of transgender workers. But it's happening. I know at the University of California, I was on the bargaining team for UAW Local 2865, the Teaching Assistant Union, and we bargained over transgender inclusive health coverage. And it's an interesting story. We didn't get it in part because of the fact that the majority of the bargaining team wasn't willing to fight hard enough for the issue. But afterward, as rank and file activists at UC Santa Cruz, we got it in our own health care. And now the union, sort of, it takes some time sometimes, but now the local at UC is bargaining over transit and health coverage. It looks like all of the grad student plans, at least in the statewide health insurance plan for grad students at UC, are going to be transgender inclusive, although not all campuses are opting into those plans at the present time, but they will in the next, likely they will have more.
Hi, I'm Daniel Lugash. I live in New York City. I'm not quite sure how to put what I have to say in the form of a question. So maybe it's just a comment that I'm trying to make openly, looking for input and feedback. I want to thank all the panelists, not least of all because you've all given me really useful stuff for some work I've been engaged in. For about the past year, attempting to initiate discourse around what I call LGBT world in the Communist Party USA, of which I'm a member. The party's formally de-homophobicized itself, if you will, but its rhetoric around the issues is archaic, and it's still very nervous when it's actually confronted with communities of LGBT people, particularly, I mean, there's LGBT people in the party, but there's a very low level of visibility. And some of us have been trying to initiate a discourse and finding that the leadership, not really knowing what to do with it, just kind of tries to ignore it altogether, which is ironic because their national headquarters is in the Chelsea district of Manhattan, where I work. Meanwhile, I'm an out communist at work, if you will, and I work in a gay porn shop in Chelsea. And a master's degree in history, so fair warning, those of you aspiring to advanced degrees in the social sciences. But our shop is incredibly supportive of you know, party, like conceptually, open to a talk about it, you know, give money when there's a fund drive. Does the party really want like a job shop or an industrial concentration in the gay porn shop, even though it represents a community in this district that they're integral to? So it's an interesting issue. Of course, the immediate, the visceral response is to polemicize around it. But I think in networking with other queers in the party interested in initiating this discourse, we're going to move away from that and actually move towards visible discourse on just a whole range of LGBT stuff so that people inside and outside the party see it going on and it can transform attitudes over time. But I don't know, really. So maybe that's my question. I mean, is it better to confront or is it better to infiltrate? But it's interesting because a lot of the resistance is around whether or not the LGBT community is really working class, or if it's really a consumer movement. And some of the sort of indirect moves against it is to reframe the issue in terms of, well, this is a wedge issue that the bosses use to divide workers. We have to figure out how to talk to workers about not letting this divide us, which, of course, entirely re-invisibilizes LGBT people. So I don't know. It's still an open question, I think, more widely on the left. I give the party credit at least for, you know, if not wanting to engage it, at least doing so openly. But like I said, I don't even know how to put it in the form of a question right now. But all of your talks were very useful towards thinking about this and trying to reframe it. So thank you.
It looks like we had another impromptu 5-minute presentation on the issue you just introduced. Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes,
I'm
okay.
Cool.
My name is Sharon O'Dear and I teach at the University of Alabama. And this isn't really, well, I sort of have two questions or comments. Maybe this one's really appropriate. This first one's really appropriate after the commie just outed himself.
Early office.
I guess, and maybe this is mostly directed at Jeff and Todd. Are gay men and lesbians more or less likely than the rest of society to be or vote Democratic? And I think that the answer to that is clearly more likely than the rest of society. So, you know, when we see figures like this, doesn't that suggest that there's something wrong with the Democratic Party? Which you would probably agree with. We don't have to answer that. I have a more fun consumerist comment, which
I think, you know, this is something I think we're all grappling with, you know, as progressive people, but also some of us who are queer. I think this article by Peter Drucker, I think is really instructive.
This isn't the management consultant.
No, I mean, 10 years ago, he edited a collection of essays on LGBT movements in the Belgian world. But this article came out in the latest issue of Against the Current, so it's the May-June issue 2010 of Against the Current. And it's one of those, I think, an instructive essay. I don't think he's not necessarily the first, but really to kind of map out different waves of the LGBT movement. And I'm old enough, and it's interesting for me to say that because my students, first students, were born in 1992. So this is around, you know, before Whitney married Bobby Brown. You know, around the Bodyguard era. But I remember in the early 90s, you know, the queer movement was incredibly powerful for me. I just started college, you know, and it opened up a space for me to think about my own sexuality. But at the same time, it was somewhat alienating because when I thought of the queer movement, the bodies that populated that movement were almost always white and gendered as male, white men, you know. But at the same time, I think Peter Drucker is useful in the sense of really trying to ask what is useful from that queer activist current, you know, the kind of, you think about the kind of radical forms of mobilization that occurred, that they developed. But also, what are some of the limitations? And I think you know, we look at these organizations like the Audre Lorde Project and, of course, for Economic Justice that are really looking at LGBT issues as a class issue. But also, I think what's interesting is to think about Peter Drucker's critique of the queer activist currents that, well, one, I mean, its roots are kind of very anarchistic, but it kind of came to voice at a time when alternatives to capitalism were ideologically, you know, discredited, right, in the global norm. You know, and I think that's something that we should consider, even in, and I think that plays out in the queer theory. So forms of resistance that are valorized in queer theory are very much based on deconstructivist modes of reading, which is like you deconstruct the text from within, you disrupt the text from within, but you can't think of an alternative beyond the text. So that's why I bring up the notion of intersectionality that in our English and Cultural Studies department, but other cultural studies courses that I took as a graduate student, the notion of intersectionality reduces difference merely to cultural forms of identity. So it's race, class, gender, right? All the different sociology textbooks that we use, race, class, gender, class is reduced to merely an identity, and we don't have a sense of understanding of capitalism. So I think it's interesting to think about how Butch Femme, this diet, is played out in terms of class. But I think, so does that mean if I dress more and act more, you know, Butch, my class status would improve? I think of those figures in Paris is Burning.
It does.
Right? Well, I think of those figures in Paris is Burning, these black and Latino gay men who can act really Butch, right, in the balls. You know, I'm going to give events on that. These large events where they play out drag, right, as drag queens, but they also play out Butch. They can play out Butch, but it doesn't improve their class status. They're still homeless at the end of the day. So I think it's Peter Drucker's, I think, analysis of the correct is I think, useful.
Can I make the follow-up? Okay, is there any reason, I mean, I guess, why, now that we're out, there's so many of us, why, I guess I would like to ask why gays and lesbians should not differentiate themselves according to taste communities. I mean, I went to the Dinah Shore a few years ago. I've been there a few times, but I like to go watch the golf. It's quiet. It's green. A lot of bikes on it and around. It's fun. But I went down and I checked out the pool party one time. And I was standing there. I didn't go in. I was going to pay $25 to listen to blazing loud rap music and watch people drink Bud Light. Right? In the 90-degree heat. Now, they had another pool party that I found out about subsequently, where they had chilled electronica and wine.
Is this an age thing you're going to?
No, it's class.
Age and class.
It's age and class. So I'm standing there, you know, I'm watching these people partying, and they're having a great time, and it's good for them, and I'm happy. And this woman comes up to me, and she says, "Hey, how'd you like to fill out this questionnaire? You can win a Olivia Cruz trip." And it's just like this, you know, to, I don't know, park down a Mazatlan, someplace on the West Coast. And I said, like this? No, I don't want to fill out a questionnaire. I'd never go on a cruise like this. And then she says to me, well, you need one of our more upscale cruises to Alaska or Tahiti. Well, that may be true, but I'm still not going on a cruise, even if it's with a bunch of guys, right? So then she just laughed, and I laughed, but you know, it struck me that I felt as if I was watching class differentiation happening right in front of my eyes among, you know, 4,000 lesbians, right? And it just seemed to me that we were a big enough group that you could do that. And I guess I don't know what necessarily is wrong with that.
Maybe others could contribute.
Yeah, I mean,
but there's a hand
there. My name is Mosa. I'm from the Africa. I mean, it's more of a question, like a comment than a question, because I mean, what you're talking about, Butch and lesbian and race issues, vision in Africa. I mean, like, at this point, we haven't reached a point where we can talk about homosexuality and make it to class, because we have to defend ourselves if it's African or not.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Also the terms of butch and feminine, where a lot of what's happening in South Africa right now, where after post-apartheid, as a homosexual, you can get married. But, and also the struggle that happened between the 1990, where there was a lot of organizations, social movements on LGBTI societies, but they were predominantly white, and white in a female and lesbian white universities and a part of the world. So after post-apartheid, a lot of struggles were so constructed into race issues, then when they legalized, we forced the government to actually make homosexuality remarried. After that, it was an issue of corrective rape, where we don't talk about rape, about class in itself, but we talk about corrective rape, because a lot of black lesbians who are butch in South Africa every single day are being raped. And you find organizations so orientated or killed. I mean, I don't know how many people have every day, and it's a matter of if you live in a township, if you're black and you're butch and you're poor, unemployed, the only identity that you have is being a butch lesbian. And in that environment where majority are poor and they don't understand this because it's not part of the culture, it becomes an issue where male will say, we'll rape that woman in order to make them straight. And it becomes that issue where it's not about class anymore, especially in like social movements around LGBTI. They don't focus about class, they focus on in the space of violence, having a stake to actually represent themselves. So it's quite interesting in terms of what you're dealing with, because in the context of South Africa and also in Africa, where it's illegal to even talk about gayness, where in Zimbabwe they say that there's no gay people, because it's illegal just to have to go to other LGBTIs, to have connections with other social movements in LGBTI in Uganda, you have to hide even anything that represents homosexuality. If you're a pamphlet, you can get arrested for that, even assuming that you're gay. Because, in Uganda, the person who went there, just because you have dry thoughts, they assume that you're gay, therefore they can actually arrest you for that.
You can get arrested from a dreadlock?
Yes, as a woman.
It's a good thing I don't have
Because that's you're lesbian. So, there is issues around that. So, it was quite interesting to start, because I actually haven't even reached that level. So, I'm just saying, it was quite mind-boggling in terms of where we are and where the north is in terms of understanding and the context that she described. It's similar but different at the same time, so the nuances that come from that as well.
Okay, let's take questions from.
Maybe there's a different way to talk about class. We can talk about race, class in general. If we went back to Marx and thought about this, I would suggest that what was foremost in Marx's mind was this condition of alienation. And he identified this in his early writings and said, there's this condition of alienation. And that's what spurred him. I've got to go figure out what the fuck's going on in this world. And then so he starts studying economy and class and competitive. If we take class and the exclusion of these other conditions and take our eye off the prize, which is a disalienated world, but we can look at those. There's a book I find pretty useful. The editors are Hekma, Arstafus, and there's one other called Ideas on the Left or something. But a lot of that focuses goes back to sort of early Marxist concepts through Feuerbach and others on alienation. And I think we can think about, well, why differentiation by class, but what's the world we're looking for? Look at the way in which Marx didn't necessarily say this, but Marx was interested in unleashing the power of the human personality. They pulled human potential to overcome that contradiction that bettered our productive forces, part of which is us as humans, and sexuality is a central function of our human personality. And arguably the repression that takes place in that regard, is a bettering of our productive abilities. And so if we kept our eye on that prize and said the issue is disalienation, and sexuality is one of the ways in which the condition of alienation, like homophobia, is one of the ways in which the condition of alienation is enforced that restricts the realization of our full creativity and humanity, I think we begin to talk about class in a different way,
that makes these issues of race, class, and gender a little more central to us from a Marxist, and enhances that Marxist perspective in a clear way. So, and provides that kind of image of what are we doing as Marxists, or what are we doing for class struggle, and it provides that imagination of the alternative. What are we really trying to do? Even Larry Cohen last night, as much as I enjoyed his talk, was saying, well, you know, what Mexico's got to do is get its economy going. And said, well, you know, if you study something like Samir Amin or third world Marxists, they're pointing out that capitalism isn't going to spread, isn't because of combined and uneven development, right? The periphery is not going to catch up. We're not going to expect that to happen. And if we keep talking about, let's get capitalism going everywhere, right, that's you know, being Brazil is not the answer. It's creating a society where we don't have these kinds of questions.
And I think this is, again, I mean, I go back to that Peter Drucker article, but also Alan Sears, and there are other LGBT people who are in communities who are really raising questions about what does it mean to have this vision of a commodified gay and lesbian lifestyle as the prize now for gay and lesbian liberation. Right. So there's nothing wrong with being on a cruise, on a limited cruise with sipping wine, but where do you go to celebrate that sexual freedom to the developing world? It's like Sex and the City, right? These four women in Sex and the City, too, where do they go? They go to the Middle East, right, to explore their issues and their anxiety with women. And this is written by a gay man, right, in Sex and the City. So, but I think it's interesting that in a highly commodified society now, that sexual freedom has been relegated to purely the realm of consumption. Right. But that privilege is...
Well, that's what our economy is based on, is consumption. I mean, I live in Alabama. I'm watching my Gulf being ruined.
Right.
And, you know, everybody's on Facebook going, oh, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. It's all of our fault because we all consume. Me, I consume a lot. I have a big carbon footprint. But we can't even talk about conservation because the economy is predicated on consumption. If we didn't consume, we wouldn't have. There would be no economic growth.
Let's take. We have time for more questions.
I was actually making a connection in my head between Sarah's talk and your all's talk, and I'm going to try to say it as succinctly as possible, which is this: I thought it was really interesting that you raised, Sarah, the connection between Prop 6 and Prop 7. Because a lot of the people who I know who lived in California during and now, I feel like that gay prop, whatever it was, that passed the anti-gay marriage proposition. Thanks. On that same ballot, there were three pretty nasty propositions that were all about either lengthening sentences or they were all sort of related to the prison industrial complex and the application of the BICNS controlling functions to people in California. And there were a lot of really interesting conversations that happened after Prop 8 passed, because I think there's so much political tension for those of us who are opposed to gay marriage as a political strategy. It's difficult to know sort of how to function in response to something like Prop 8, right? Especially when there's these three other ballot initiatives that frankly seem more important on the ballot. And in the wake of most of those things passing anyway, I think one of the PAC-related ones did not pass. There was a lot of conversation about how, if there had been the energy and sort of the foresight, how both the racism of the No On Prop 8 campaign as it moved forward could have been countered by the people who were working from a sort of racial and class justice perspective on these other areas. Just, there was a lot about why those two things didn't come together. And essentially the polarization that you're talking about around the frustration about sort of gay politics coming about marriage, making people turn from that and move toward doing, you know, economic and racial justice work that clearly affects some queer people. And so I'm really interested in the kind of alignment between sort of what you're talking about, this one group of people, the lesbian school workers, who actually chose to focus on the death penalty stuff at the same time, and then what you all are doing is really organizations that are saying, you know, this is queer politics. Like, queer politics is racial justice, right? So this is the option we have, and this is the option we're taking. And I'm just really interested in sort of where you think those things can go, given that HRC, you know, has so much money and has so much, you know, what I'm trying to say. So I'm curious what the political sort of possibilities are as you both see them in relationship with the things you talked about.
Well, I will say this. Thank you. In part, I've been ruminating about responses to your questions based on various questions and comments. And I think the point that's helped me is your pointing back to this alienation in the ways in which we can think about not simply solidarities, but the vital question of solidarity toward what. And I think Andrew Davis's whole conception, partly coming out of her study and acting upon Marxism, is the question of, well, what do you want equality with? And I think it's that equality with question, you know, in the African context, in the African American context, you know, in the context of, you know, where we are. That's a fundamental one. To me, we have a fascinating opportunity, and we're extending upon this project in the sense that we're going to do, along with our textual and you know, analysis by data, we're also going to do extensive interviews. But one in which we have completed is with Kenyon Farrell, who is the executive director of QEJ, Chris for Economic Justice. And Kenyon sort of brought it to a key point in our thinking when he talked about the QEJ's involvement in homelessness. And the various ways, I mean, and I in my previous work have studied questions of economic justice and housing. And, you know, just sort of walk your way through all of the questions that confront LGBT families, you know, in particular couples, trans, you know, gender citizens, in terms of, well, when I have to confront the issue of where a shelter provider chooses to house me and my family, where are parts of me and parts of my family housed? Can I and my partner, who are coupled and may be married by that conception, stay in a women's shelter versus, you know, and will I be safe when I stay there? As a, you know, one of the issues they're confronting is the safety of transgender persons. But I suspect you can extend it beyond, you know, extend it to the question of non-gender conforming citizens and you know, and their safety within that shelter system. And I think at the very least you can begin to connect these dots on the issue itself to say it is part of the broader issue that of economic justice as you conceive it anyway. I'm hoping, I don't know if I'll be able to, I'm hoping that there's also this question being raised at the World Social Forum in Detroit that's coming up later in June. About where is the queer left? You know, I think, you know, the broader question of where is the left is relevant. And the queer left even more telling. But you know, to me, it's and I'll just say it in this way: it's sort of the intersectionality plus is the sense that it's not just like we're sort of talking on the terrain of the particular issue of housing that those who are concerned about housing should come to the table about. But ultimately, you know, what's your view of transformation? You know, I remember an activist that I interviewed in Detroit about what was her vision of the broader goal, and she says it's more than just a drop in the bucket. I mean, you know, we've done a drop in the bucket, but we really do want more than a drop in the bucket. And so anyway, my comment's a little nebulous, but those connections to me start with these fundamental questions, and I thank you in terms of making that linkage.
We have time for one more question.
Can I just respond really quickly to that? I think there's a lot of potential right now, and I think it's in groups like the two groups that you talked about. I think it's in potentials in a group like San Francisco Pride at Work, which also sort of calls itself Queers for Economic Justice. It's about prioritizing. It's about setting your political priorities, I think, because Pride at Work in San Francisco / Queer Youth Organizing Project / Queers for Economic Justice, what they do is they have an immigrant rights project, they have a queer rights project, they have a housing rights project, and they have a labor rights project. but they do not focus on marriage, they do not focus on the military, you know, they don't focus on these things. And I think it's difficult when you say, I'm going to focus on marriage, but I'm also going to do these other things, because there's almost only so much time in the day. We're all overworked and very much alienated, you know, so you have to reset your priorities. Because I think I found after Proposition 8, I was like really upset about Proposition 8, I was going to get involved in something, and One Struggle, One Fight formed. It was a grassroots anti-racist group in San Francisco wanting to address the issue of gay marriage, but also saying we can't only address this issue. So we organized, we had an action that we organized, and it was supposed to be a more sort of broadly based kind of action focusing on other things besides just Proposition 8. It came very diluted and ended up focusing most entirely on Proposition 8. And at that point, I decided this is not where my priorities are, because I think you have to reset your priorities. It's not about, you know, and I think the model, these are the other models are the way to go. And it's about doing it from the grassroots. The HRC just mobilized an army of counselors that are poorly paid and, you know, union busted, right? So, like, they don't mobilize at the grassroots. People have to mobilize themselves to the grassroots and reset the priorities.
Okay. I wanted to give a plug for the book Perspectively Queer by Jane Ward. I just finished reading it last week. It's so good. It's about diversity, like doing diversity the way it's done, so influenced by corporate diversity practices, but queer organizations doing diversity in a way that's middle class cultural capital. And so therefore, ironically, it advances the careers of this very narrow band of much more privileged people. So leaving out most diverse people out of the diversity work. So it's really, really good. But I think there's all these complications and ironies, and Kim, I just feel like I was there for some of the history you were talking about. Like, you really nail a lot of things, which I really, really appreciate in the weird moment of the 70s. But I wanted to add a couple of those.
That whole weird decade, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, weird. But I wanted to do a couple of those complications. You said it's probably more complicated. The sort of traditionalist versus queer culturalist, which ones are more likely to be men and which ones are more likely to be lesbians. So I'm from Massachusetts. I got married to my girlfriend legally. When we got a Vermont civil union first, and we saw this demographic breakdown of who had gotten Vermont civil unions, and we're like, oh my goodness, that's us. You know, it was like, it was white Massachusetts women with master's degrees, you know. We were like, whoa, they captured us like that en masse. We are our demographic.
Yeah, but that's not really that surprising, is it? I mean, women are kind of nesters, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
The issue who you all go to Massachusetts and get married, we're set.
Yeah, and so that's so similarly, it's majority, you know, it's disproportionately women that have gotten legally married in Massachusetts. And but I think in terms of so when you're saying gay men are the most traditionalist,
I don't think. I think that white gay men have the opportunity to spearhead this, and I don't think that whether you get married or not plays into it in the same kind of big ways as monogamy and looking heteronormative. And it does figure in, but I would never argue that women are, I'm sure, getting married and are responsible for more heterosexual marriages than men, too.
Well, that's true, too.
Right. I think women like to get married.
Well, that's what I'm talking
about. I don't know why.
Just an
traditional, traditional in lifestyle and traditional in which way of thinking about queerness, I think that those are sort of, those don't line up. But because I think because of the history of lesbian feminism being much, you know, there's a lot of lesbians who have multi-movement experience and so are just much more likely to put race and class and other issues into activism. And so traditional living but more radical queer thinking. So National Gay and Lesbian Task Force seems to be disproportionately women. HRC seems to be disproportionately women. and that's what I think you were sort of talking about here is the traditional. So, anyway, I just wanted to mess up the
half. Yeah, I think there's plenty of women. I think there's plenty of women in that group, and like I said, it's not necessarily bad. They're just different, and they're just happening. I mean, this is happening, and I think that whole thing and was shared too is that when we differentiate and change, and what we like to do, and when we want marriage or don't want marriage. I mean, we're all over with that one, aren't we? But it's not okay to alienate people from any of those. And right. Every time we make those kinds of choices, we leave someone in alienation. You know, when we choose to get a master's or a PhD and to get married or to illustrate or to pass or to do any of those things, we leave someone out because then we get comfortable with, oh, I'm gay and it's okay. Well, I stayed in university and it's okay. But you know what? If I go to Alabama, I can't even go in and get a barbecue beef sandwich when it's church time because you know somebody's afraid I'll be killed for doing that. So it's really not okay then, is it? So those choices, all I'm saying is those choices that we make, and I make them too, right? Still leaves people alienated, and we need to think about that as lesbians. I think probably more as white people. I think it's easier for us to deal with white people. Although I think that you know African Americans are certainly moving in a direction where they're more able to do it than they were before, which is good and bad, isn't it? You know, and lesbians more than before is good and bad. So I don't want you to decide to be the bad side. I just want to say, what are we doing? What are we doing? You know, how is this hurting other people?
Thank you very much.